Our web stream is made possible by donations from our listeners. Please go to WPKN.org to make a contribution or become a member of the WPKN community.
And that music brought to you by Search, the Brooklyn-based band. The CD's called Today is Tomorrow. It's on Search Music, and something called Herds. Herds. Yes, Today is Tomorrow is the name of the CD, and that came out a little earlier this year. Before that, you heard from Nelly Mackay, Normal as Blueberry Pie. That's the name of the CD. And something called Crazy Rhythm, Nelly Mackay, Normal as Blueberry Pie, a tribute to Doris Day. Kick things off with a CD called, it's called The Soul of Brazil. It's a very various artist release from producer Jacques Berbick. The Soul of Brazil, the name of the CD. Various artists, and you heard from Marva King, vocals from her, and something called They Say. They Say from Marva King, from the various artists released from producer Jacques Berwick. Now, I have some weather for you, just before I leave you. Tonight, rain and drizzle. Lows in the lower 40s. Tuesday, cloudy, rain and drizzle likely, mainly in the morning with highs in the lower 50s. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with lows around 40. Wednesday, partly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Wednesday night looks like this. If you're going to start heading out to your various locations for Thanksgiving, Wednesday night, mostly cloudy, a chance of light rain after midnight with lows in the lower 40s. Thanksgiving Day shapes up like this. Mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of light rain with highs in the mid-50s. Thursday night, rain, lows in the lower 40s. Chance of rain, 80%. Friday, yes, Black Friday for those of you crazy enough to head out. Friday, cloudy, rain likely in the morning, then scattered showers in the afternoon with highs in the upper 40s. Friday night, if you're heading out, cloudy, a chance of showers in the evening with lows around 40. That's it for me. My name's Patrick O'Sullivan. You've been tuned to another edition of Jazz Variations over 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport and 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. Scott Harris is next with Counterpoint. He'll have something interesting to talk about. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Now here is the White Rose Political Calendar.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles for political, social, economic, and environmental justice. Here are this week's listings. From Tuesday, November 24th through Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 26th, the Amistad Catholic Worker is looking for volunteers to help deliver Thanksgiving baskets to needy neighbors, as well as to help cook and serve Thanksgiving dinner at their house of hospitality, 203 Rosette Street in New Haven. The Catholic Worker movement provides the basic necessities of life for those in need while working towards social justice for all. For more information, call 203-624-5517 or email amistadcwh@yahoo.com. That's 203-624-5517 or email amistadcwh@yahoo.com. On Monday, November 30th, join other Long Islanders as the World March for Peace and Nonviolence passes through New York City. The march is an unprecedented social mobilization calling for nuclear disarmament at a global level, the immediate withdrawal of invading troops from occupied territories, the progressive and proportional reduction of conventional weapons, the signing of non-aggression treaties between countries, and the renunciation by governments of the use of war as a means to resolve conflicts. Long Island peace groups will be organizing vans as well as a train option. For more information, visit the group's website at worldmarchusa.net or contact George at 516-249-7517. That's 516-249-7517. On Wednesday, December 2nd, the documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, will be shown at the Cinema Arts Center, 423 Park Avenue, Huntington, New York. At 5 p.m., food will be served. At 6 p.m., there will be poetry and music. And the film begins at 7 p.m., followed by discussion, featuring a webcast with either Daniel Ellsberg or filmmaker Rick Goldsmith. Ellsberg, a high-level Pentagon official, risked his career and imprisonment in 1971 by releasing top-secret documents about the U.S. war in Vietnam. For more information, including ticket prices, call Brown Paper Tickets toll-free at 1-800-838-3006. That's 1-800-838-3006. On Saturday, December 5th, come to the New Haven Leon Sister City Project's annual Gift Bazaar from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church, 704 Whitney Avenue, New Haven. The site is wheelchair accessible. Refreshments and live music begin at noon. Admission is free, and fair trade items from many countries as well as local products will be available for sale, such as Palestinian olive oil, local honey, the Syracuse Cultural Workers' Calendar, and Nicaraguan chocolate, pottery, and woven goods. Proceeds support the work of the Sister City Project for Justice and Economic Development in León and other parts of Nicaragua. For more information, contact Patty at 203-562-1607. That's 203-562-1607. Or email pnewelson@newhavenleon.org. That's P as in Patty, N-U-E-L-S-E-N, at newhavenleon, L-E-O-N.org. On Sunday, December 6th, Keep the Ball Rolling, to Win Jobs with Union Rights, Healthcare, Peace, and Equality, is the theme for this year's presentation of the Amistad Awards by the People's Weekly World to mark the 90th anniversary of the Communist Party USA. The event will be held at 4 p.m. at the People Center, 37 Howe Street in New Haven. Music and a buffet will be part of the event. Three local labor leaders will be honored. For more information and ticket prices, call 203-624-8664. That's 203-624-8664. To include your group's upcoming events in the listings of the White Rose Political Calendar, send information about national, regional, and local events 2 weeks in advance when possible to whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. That's whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. And you can see the calendar posted on the WPKN.org website. This week's calendar was produced by Melinda Tudor.
Stay tuned next for Counterpoint coming up next. Here on WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Beat it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High fire in a fire. Representatives have engaged in a government for hire at the combat site. Let the weapon come in a hurry with the fury breathing down your my team reporters battle Trump, get a crop, look at that, no claim, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, well, serve your own needs, listen to your heartbeat, dummy, with the rapture and the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it.
burn, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book burning, blood letting. Every motive escalate, automotive incinerate. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, step down. Watch a heel crush, crush up. Oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Turn them in, a turn them in, a turn them in, a fly. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. Sign, Leonid, Brad, Snap, Lenny, Bush, and Lester Banks. Birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom. Symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, nap. Right?
Right.
It's the end of
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint here at WPKN in Bridgeport. Here every Monday between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you could be with us tonight. In a little while this evening, we're going to be speaking with Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. We're going to be talking about Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other accused terrorists in New York City, the federal court there, and the controversy that has aroused. Later tonight, James Douglas will be joining us, author of the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. This is a book we've talked about before, but here on the 46th anniversary of the JFK's assassination, we're going to revisit some of these larger issues here, including the specter of Vietnam during the Kennedy presidency and what he may have done had he lived. And some of the parallels with decisions facing President Obama in Afghanistan. Lastly, tonight we'll be speaking with Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. We'll be taking a look at some of the political races heating up in the state, including Connecticut Governor Jody Rell's announcement that she won't be running for re-election, Chris Dodd's Senate seat, and the backlash against Joe Lieberman for his threat to join Republicans in a filibuster to block health care reform legislation with a public option. But first tonight, we're very pleased to welcome to the program Jules Lobel, professor of international constitutional law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, an organization that has fought so hard to preserve our civil liberties and just basic rights here in this country in the specter of this war on terrorism, and well before that, of course. Jules, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I just wanted to retrace some history about the topic we'll be talking about, and that is ACORN. Center for Constitutional Rights has actually begun a case challenging Congress's recent defunding of ACORN. But if we're going to go back a little bit to find out some of the origins of this recent defunding move by Congress, it was, I guess, back last summer when conservative activist James O'Keefe and his friend Hannah Giles traveled across the U.S. this past summer to offices of the community organization group ACORN, which is really the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, that's their actual name, where the couple posed as a pimp and prostitute, asking ACORN employees for help in obtaining housing loans to open a brothel for underage Salvadoran girls. And, of course, These encounters were secretly videotaped. Most of us have seen them, and later broadcast nationwide, creating a firestorm among conservatives and Republicans who demanded ACORN be stripped of all federal funding for their various programs. And in mid-Congress, Congress did exactly that. They voted by wide margins in both the House and Senate to defund ACORN from the federal programs and contracts that they had signed on to. So, Jules, why don't you tell us about the suit that the Center for Constitutional Rights had launched just last week on November 12th?
Well, the suit we filed on behalf of ACORN and several other organizations alleges that the defunding of ACORN is unconstitutional, and let me explain why. The first and basic reason is that it's a bill of attainder. Now, most people don't know anything about a bill of attainder. In fact, I didn't know all that much about it before we started this suit. But a bill of attainder says that Congress cannot name somebody specifically and punish them. So they can't say, well, Mr. X, you've committed a crime, and we're going to put you in jail for 20 years, or we're going to kick you out of government employment. I mean, probably the most famous bill of attainder case was in the 1940s, when Congressman Deves got up in the floor of Congress and said, I have 87 names of government employees who are subversives, and we should get rid of all of them from government employment. And Congress passed a bill taking away all appropriations from those 87 named employees, and they fired them, and a number of them sued, and the Supreme Court held that was unconstitutional. What's unconstitutional about it is that the job of Congress is to pass laws which say such and such conduct is illegal, or this conduct is inconsistent with being a government worker. And then it's the job of the courts or executive agencies to adjudicate who falls within that category. What Congress can't do is say, you are guilty of a crime, because then Congress is acting as the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury all at once. And under our principles of democracy and separation of powers, Congress can't do that. Congress can only pass laws which then the executive and the judiciary have to enforce. If Congress gets into the job of naming names and deciding who it's going to penalize, then we're going down the road of McCarthyism in this country, because then Congress can say not just ACORN, but then they can say to the next group, we don't like you, and we're going to punish you in some way, either by defunding you or by kicking you out of government employment or by putting you in jail. And that would really go against the core principles of our democracy. So that's our basic claim here, that this is an unconstitutional bill of attainder, and that was raised in the House. But most people, you know, the Republicans were out to get ACORN, as they, that's what they actually said in the House, that they wanted to get ACORN. And the Democrats, many of the Democrats, were too weak and afraid to be associated with ACORN, so they got on the bandwagon and voted for this too. But that's exactly why you want a judicial trial and not a legislative trial, because the judiciary, you have to present evidence. The evidence has to be, somebody has to testify. They can be cross-examined, and then a judge and a jury could decide if the evidence is right. That's not what happened in Congress. What happened in Congress is somebody got up and said, ACORN's a fraudulent organization, a criminal organization. Everybody who agrees with me, vote for this. There was never any hearing, never any trial, and this is it's un-American. It's contrary to our basic principles. And we took the suit because even though right now ACORN is a disfavored organization, we felt that we have to fight for the basic principles of law and the basic principles of democracy. And if they can do this to ACORN, they can do this to anybody.
Jules, does Congress have the right to cut off funds to an organization without hearings, without a judicial court case being heard and adjudicated?
Well, Congress has the right to cut off funds for particular activities. For example, Congress can say any organization that engages in fraud can be denied funding, or any organization that engages in tax violations can be denied funding. But in fact, of course, we know that there are dozens of corporations and defense contractors and other government contractors that have been convicted of fraud, convicted of very serious crimes, and still get government funding. And nobody in Congress, they've been protected. So even though Congress can pass general statutes, they can't. What they can't do is try a particular organization and decide that that organization is going to get no funding whatsoever. That's what we have. You know, we have a whole regulatory mechanism to do that. So if an agency determines that an organization is not doing the job or it's committed misconduct, they have a hearing and they can defund that. But Congress can't just do it by ipso, you know, just by its own verdict. They can't just say this is what we want to do. They can cut off funding for activities. They could say we're not going to have any more mortgage lending counseling, or we're not going to have any more tax advising. But they can't single out an organization and say this organization and no other is going to be denied funding. They could say any organization that commits fraud and or is convicted of fraud. And if they did that, there would be dozens of defense contractors and other contractors that would be denied funding. So Congress doesn't want to do that. They don't want to deny many of them their friends and people who have paid for their campaigns. They don't want to deny those people funding. So instead of passing some general law, they say, well, we're just going to specifically go after ACORN, and that's what's prohibited by the Constitution. That's a bill of attainder.
And just, thinking about recent headlines in years past, Boeing Corporation, a military contractor, as well as the producer of civilian airliners, they've been accused and, I believe, judged in court to have committed hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud with government contracts. So has the pharmaceutical company Pfizer and many others, health insurance companies, Blackwater. I'm thinking of a whole list of corporations.
Of murder.
Of murder. Or something far worse than fraud. So, have any of these other companies with a track record of with a court case and judged to have been guilty of fraud or worse, as in the case of Blackwater, of murder? Have any of these companies been held to account? Do we know?
Not by Congress. Not by Congress, and many of them not by the agencies. In fact, the GAO and the Government Accounting Office did a study, and it found that numerous government corporations that had been convicted not only once but sometimes twice of serious crimes were still getting government funding. Congress did nothing about it. Congress, to my knowledge, at least in the recent history, has never gone after one particular corporation or one organization and cut off its funding. This is the first time that it's done that, and it's done it clearly as a political hatchet job on ACORN. It's done it because they've decided that they want to go after ACORN, and that is, that's the job, as I said, of judges, juries, and prosecutors after a full scale hearing, not of Congress getting up and in some vote where nobody even, you know, there was no hearing, there was no real debate, just cut off funding.
So what's your goal here? Temporary restraining order, but in this hostile political environment towards ACORN, what really can be done to restore their funds? Or is that your ultimate goal here?
Well, our goal is twofold. One is to enjoin this statute, which we think we have a good chance of doing, because we think that, as I said, it's both unprecedented and unconstitutional. And it shows, by the way, that the very people who are out to get ACORN because they say ACORN has violated the law are themselves violating the Constitution. But second, we want to show, we want to get a declaratory judgment and show more broadly that this kind of attack, this kind of legislative attack, without any hearing, without any due process on an organization, is not permitted under our Constitution, not only to protect ACORN, but in general, to stop what we believe is a right-wing assault on the rule of law. And that's, I think, what's at issue here. It's not simply ACORN. It's the rule of law and the rule of the Constitution itself. And if we can beat back this attack on ACORN, hopefully then ACORN would be entitled to a fair hearing. And if ACORN has committed fraud or misconduct and they're adjudicated by a court or by hearing officers in an agency, then of course those agencies have the right to cut off funding to ACORN. But that would be only after some fair process. So hopefully we'd be able to protect ACORN not from a cutoff of funds, but just from a cutoff of funds without any due process, without any fair hearing. But secondly, more importantly, as I say, or equally importantly, we want to protect the American people and other organizations from people in Congress who would take it upon themselves to be all powerful and to say, you know, we can do anything. We can judge you guilty of something, or you or some other organization guilty of something, because if you allow that to happen to one organization, the right wing impetus behind this will then go after other people.
Jules Lobel is our guest, professor of international and constitutional law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're talking about a lawsuit to reverse what Congress did in defunding the community organization group ACORN. Jules, how has Congress's vote to defund ACORN affected the organization's operations and programs in the offices unconnected with this pimp prostitute video news blast that really affected the image of the organization very negatively?
Well let me say one thing about that video, which is that, these were employees who did something wrong, and it's my understanding that ACORN has fired those employees and has tried to take steps to reform itself. And there's no question that ACORN probably needed some reforms, and I think they're going about doing that. So one can judge whether they've done it in a good way or correct way, but we shouldn't let the actions of just of a couple of employees tar, as you suggest, a whole organization, which clearly has done some good work and has won awards for their work. And what this funding did was cut off not only for programs that were had some problems with it, but even for programs that everybody agreed was doing good work and was serving an underprivileged and underserved communities. The effect that this has been dramatic on many ACORN organizations. For example, the New York ACORN Housing Corporation has had its mortgage counseling services totally threatened, so that poor people who are at risk of losing their house and need somebody to help them negotiate with the bank to reduce their mortgage rates now are totally at the mercy of predatory lenders and banks who may not be at all in helping them. So that's one thing. The ACORN Institute, which is one of the plaintiffs here, which gets a lot of federal funds, has had off about 80% of their staff. So it's had a dramatic effect on the work of this organization, and I think we have to realize that even in the short run, it's the effect is not just on the organization, but the poor communities that are served by this organization, and which don't receive very many services. So what you have is communities that are desperately in need of these services having these services dramatically cut off right in midstream.
As we were talking about before, this video, it seems that there were these conservative activists who went from office to office of ACORN around the country, actually had the police called on them in some ACORN offices. I know in Philadelphia there's documentation.
In Philadelphia they were kicked out.
They were kicked out, and also I think there's a police report about it. So, you know, the idea that some employees played along with it either as a joke or seriously, and for, you know, which they should be fired, but it's, you know, this conservative activist was not a disinterested party. He had an axe to grind, and whatever way he edited the video that was shown on national television certainly probably wasn't a fair representation of what happened in all those offices with this little scam that he put together. But, you know, Acorn has certainly been a punching bag for the Republican Party for a long time because they've been very successful at registering voters all across
right,
the country.
Right, exactly.
And, but the organization has had some financial improprieties. I guess the founder's brother had embezzled almost $1 million 10 years ago. They straightened out some of their accounting procedures. But, the silliest thing I heard, Jules, and you can speak to this, Acorn was tied by, the right-wing Rush Limbaugh Fox News echo chamber as somehow being the whole reason the subprime housing mortgage meltdown occurred. Somehow, you know, giving poor people mortgages was the fault of Acorn, and that brought down the house of cards with the mortgage industry. I mean, that's an accusation a lot of people in this country believe.
Well, it's unbelievable how Acorn now has been demonized as being behind all the evils. For example, I think what you just said is ridiculous, and yet people believe it. I just ran across a poll that somebody did where they asked the question, how many people thought that. Do you think that Obama won the 2008 election legitimately, or do you think that the election was stolen by Acorn? And the astounding thing about this poll was that 52% of the people who identified themselves as a Republican answered the question that they think the election was stolen by Acorn. So now they're not only being blamed for the whole mortgage crisis, but they claim that Acorn fraudulently stole the 2008 election.
Yeah, well, you know, it really goes to the problem of media in this country and the weakness, as you said at the outset, of the Democratic Party and how they deal with these challenges and these stunts that the Republican and the conservatives seem to, are very skilled at, demonizing this or that group or that person. It's quite amazing, and it seems the Democrats don't know how to play hardball with these guys.
Well, they don't seem to have the backbone and courage, many of the Democrats, to stand up to this and to say, you know, what you're doing is wrong. Even if they say that they're not a defender of Acorn, they can say this is against constitutional principle. And they took an oath to abide by the Constitution, and yet they just passed the statute, which is clearly unconstitutional, or at least it seems clearly unconstitutional, and nobody said anything about it. And I think it was because they were trying to get some political cover and not be tarred with, you know, the right-wing scandal on Acorn. So I think what you need is for a lot of these Democrats to have more courage in many different areas to stand up for principles and to stand up for the rule of law. And to, you know, it's the same thing with Guantanamo because the center represented the detainees in Guantanamo, and when Bush said, well, I want a law to take away their habeas corpus rights, many of the Democrats caved in because they didn't want to be seen as supporting terrorism and supporting terrorists, even though it was clearly unconstitutional and the Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional.
Well, you know, it would be fair turnaround for anybody who thought what the Republicans did to grandstand about Acorn to talk about AIG, the Bank of America, Citibank, Boeing, as we talked about before, mm-hmm. Pfizer, any number of health insurance companies, Blackwater, as we talked about. You know, it's sad that these arguments are carried out to their logical extension to say what's fair for one is fair for all. And in the end, I think we have a class warfare against poor people here that's succeeding every day.
Exactly.
That's
the problem.
Jules, thanks so much for fighting this fight and letting our listeners know about it. How can our folks listening get more details about this lawsuit on the Acorn defunding issue, as well as some of the other wonderfully important projects Center for Constitutional Rights works then?
Well, I think the best thing would be to go onto the Center for Constitutional Rights website, which if you just Google Center for Constitutional Rights, you'll get to that website, and that'll give you know, I think we have a great website which will give you all sorts of information about this and other good projects that we're involved in.
Yeah, especially on the war on terror issues that we speak frequently with Michael Ratner about, and other folks from the center. Jules Lobel, thanks so much for joining us. And I think that website is ccrjustice.org, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. I was reluctant to actually say it because sometimes I get it, you know, you get one letter wrong or something. So if for some reason it's wrong, you just put in Center for Constitutional Rights and you'll get to the website.
To any search engine, ccrjustice.org. Jules Lobel, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Okay, thank you for having me, and thanks for doing your show. It's a very important show.
Thank you, Jules. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Jules Lobel, professor of international constitutional law and at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, talking about the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit to reverse this defunding decision by Congress on ACORN. Stay tuned. We'll be back with a discussion of the terrorist trials slated for New York City with Marjorie Cohn in just a moment. Stay with us. Music from David Byrne here on Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. Our website is WPKN.org, where you can find out more about our daily schedule and even a place to make a secure online contribution to this listener-sponsored radio station. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Thanks so much for joining us, Marjorie.
My pleasure, Scott.
Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, accused mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks, and four other terrorist suspects in a New York City federal court has ignited a national debate, which we've been treated to daily in the media over the last week or so. Republicans have attacked the venue for the 9/11 trial, declaring it brings unnecessary risk of new terrorist attacks against New York City residents, gives Khalid Sheikh Mohammed an international platform to glorify al-Qaeda and attack the United States, and they say will provide 9/11 defendants access to highly classified evidence and intelligence. And Marjorie, I'm wondering how you react to this kind of firestorm of objections from people, some of whom supported civilian trials for terrorists in past trials.
Yes, well, the federal courts in the United States are perfectly well suited to protect high security detainees. We've had many, many terrorism trials and people serving time, including life sentences for acts of terrorism. And we have the Classified Information Procedures Act, which judges and prosecutors who have handled terrorism cases in U.S. courts say are perfectly effective in protecting classified information. So I think that this is really blowing a lot of hot air. I think it's political posturing on the part of some Republicans, not all. And I think that we should look at the facts, and that is that the federal courts have, since 2001, 289 individuals have been charged with terrorism-related offenses in federal courts. Some of them are still pending, but federal prosecutors convicted 195 out of 214 defendants. That's a success rate of 91%. That includes Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, who's now serving a life sentence in federal prison. And federal courts have also been the venue for prosecuting and convicting cases involving the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombing. And if we look at what's happened with the Guantanamo detainees, there have been no convictions by the so-called legal system at Guantanamo of any individuals associated with the 9/11 attacks. In fact, after 7 years that the Guantanamo prison has been open, the legal system there has led to the prosecution and conviction of only three detainees. And two of them had sentences of less than a year, and both detainees were subsequently released. So there's really no good reason to oppose trials in U.S. federal courts. I think more alarming is the fact that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is picking and choosing different levels of due process depending upon how easy he thinks it would be to get a conviction. So some people get more due process than others. A colleague, Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, is going to get a federal trial with all the due process rights, and yet five other people, including Abdel Rahim al-Nashiri, who is accused of masterminding the 2000 attack on the USS Cold Warship in Yemen, and the juvenile Canadian Omar Khadr, who's accused of killing a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan, are going to have to be tried in military commissions. And these are military commissions, and an earlier iteration of these military commissions was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Now, they have been revised, but they're still fundamentally flawed in a number of ways. So I would like to see all of these detainees, for whom there is probable cause to believe they've committed a crime, tried in federal civilian U.S. courts with full due process rights.
Marjorie, it seems that a lot of this criticism, not all, is blatantly political. Former mayor of New York City, Rudolph Giuliani, applauded the New York City trial of those who carried out the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, but of course has reversed position here, really viciously attacking the Obama administration for having a very similar kind of trial for terrorists in 2009.
That's true, but you know, there was an op-ed in Friday's Washington Post by Jim Comey and Jack Goldsmith, both of whom served in the Attorney General's office during the Bush administration, and they actually support Holder's decision. They said that a trial in Manhattan will bring enormous media scrutiny and also require unprecedented security, but they said that it's unlikely to make New York a bigger target than it has been since February 1993. When colleague Sheikh Mohammed's nephew Ramzi Youssef attacked the World Trade Center, and they favor these trials in federal courts, and these are two people who were right in the middle of the Bush administration. And you know, it looks to me like Obama has prejudged the cases. When he was asked about Holder's decision, he said, well, these people won't find it, quote, offensive at all when he's convicted and when the death penalty is applied to him, unquote. And so here he's prejudging colleague Sheikh Mohammed's case. I also am very alarmed at the different levels of detention and treatment that the Obama-Holder administration is intending to carry out. They say they have, the administration says that about 40 of the 215 detainees still at Guantanamo will be tried in federal court or military commissions. And then they said about 75 more have been deemed too dangerous to release but can't be prosecuted because of evidentiary issues and limits on the use of classified material. And so they're basically talking about indefinite detention without trial, which is illegal. If you have probable cause to believe somebody committed a crime, you bring them to trial. And there was a very, very insightful letter to the editor, to the New York Times, on November the 14th by John Capel, who's a career appellate attorney with the Justice Department, and he said that he found it troubling that administration officials, quote, also suggested that they could continue to detain anyone deemed to be a combatant under Congress's authorization to use military force, thereby indicating an intention to continue to hold some of the suspects regardless of the outcome of the trial. And he says that unless the United States is prepared to release these men if they're acquitted, or in the perhaps more likely event that the charges against them are dismissed on due process grounds because they have been subjected to procedures that shock the conscience, it is arguably merely conducting a show trial. The government can't have it both ways. And I thought that that was a really, really telling letter from someone who is works in the Department of Justice, has for his whole career.
No, I think, as you said, President Obama's comments presupposing the guilt and execution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as well as Eric Holder's contention that if for some astonishing reason he were to be acquitted, that he would not be released. And as you just said, this really does appear to be a show trial. And for what purpose, do you think?
Well, I think that they want to show that they're tough on terror. They're confident, I think, that they can get a conviction. Even though, now remember, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded, I can't remember how many times, numerous times, several times a day for a long period of time, ostensibly, according to the Senate Armed Services Committee report, to create a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, so to justify Bush's illegal war on Iraq, and that connection was never made. But he was tortured, and who knows what his mental state is now. And the other thing that is quite outrageous is that the Pentagon knows that a lot of evidence or information that was tortured out of people, aside from the fact that it's probably unreliable information, but it can't be used. They re-interviewed these people with, quote, clean teams, unquote, going through the same questions with them, but without the torture and abuse. And whatever information they got, they can say, oh, this was uncoerced, after they'd already tortured the hell out of them. So it is disturbing that the Obama administration is following somewhat in the footsteps of the Bush administration in terms of picking and choosing and treating these people with less than full due process, and I'm talking about the people that they're going to try in military commissions and the people that they plan to hold indefinitely, and that's quite alarming.
One thing that seems clear, however you feel about the federal trial in New York City of these 9/11 terrorists, it seems almost impossible to get an impartial jury impaneled here, don't you think?
Yes, and it's interesting how it's become a real political football whether or not they should be tried in New York City near the site of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But I'm certain that the defense attorneys will make a motion to change the venue out of New York City, because I agree it would be very difficult to get a fair trial, and I think that trying them there is also will contribute to the show trial atmosphere, besides the fact that it would be hard to get a fair trial, as you said.
Part of the political campaign against the decision by Eric Holder to hold this terrorism trial in New York City is that you would have a situation where just to go back to another issue here, the tenets and principles of the U.S. Constitution. It seems that a lot of people are very fearful of following the Constitution, and that seems, ever more present after the 9/11 attacks.
That's true, and there's also a lot of anti-immigrant hysteria. There's a lot of racism. The Constitution shouldn't apply to them, and these people haven't read the Due Process Clause. The Due Process Clause says that the government shall not deny any person, it doesn't say citizen, it says any person, the due process of the law. And that has been interpreted by our Supreme Court to apply even to non-U.S. citizens. So, the Bush administration tried to to keep the people at Guantanamo away from any U.S. courts, and fought tooth and nail to keep them from having the right to habeas corpus to challenge their confinement. They've kept nearly 800 men and boys at one time or another locked up like animals in cages at Guantanamo to create a legal black hole, and the overwhelming majority of them have no connection to any kind of terrorism at all. And many of them are still being held because they can't be repatriated. The Uyghurs from China, for example, should have been sent to the United States. They are innocent of any terrorism. They've been found to be innocent, and yet they're continuing to hold them. So it's, again, this has been a political football. Obama pledged that he would close Guantanamo a year after his inauguration, and now when he was in China, he backtracked on that, said he's not going to do it. And Congress actually voted to deny any funds to bring Guantanamo detainees here until he had a plan, because he didn't have a plan before. Now that he has it looks like he might have a plan and send many of them to a prison, high security prison that is almost empty, about 150 miles from Chicago. The Congress has reversed itself, and that's also been a political football among many on the right. This NIMBY, not in my backyard. Why are they going to bring these people, these terrorists, to Thompson, Illinois? Even though both senators from Illinois and the governor of Illinois favor it because they think it'll create jobs, and three prominent conservatives, David Keene, who founded the American Conservative Union, Grover Norquist, the president of Americans for Tax Reform, and Bob Barr, who used to be in Congress, are supporting the transfer of these alleged terrorists to Illinois.
I was just remembering what I was trying to ask you before, and that is critics of a civilian trial for these accused 9/11 terrorists say they don't deserve the rights of a civilian court, and after all, the 9/11 attack was an act of war, so this more properly belongs in a military commission. How do you respond to that issue of, you know, the venue based on the act of terrorism?
Well, this was not an act of war. These were crimes against humanity. When 19 men, 15 of whom came from Saudi Arabia, they didn't come from Afghanistan or Iraq or Pakistan, they came from Saudi Arabia, most of them, got on planes and used them to kill 3,000 civilians. That's a crime against humanity. We were not attacked by another government. That was not an act of war, and I think the right has really used that to fan the flames of anti-immigrant and immigration reform. There's been, as I said, a lot of racism, and also to try to deny these people due process. The former Navy General Counsel Alberto Mora testified before Congress and said something very, very telling. And keep this in mind when we see that Guantanamo will not be closed anytime soon, and that a lot of these abuses continue. And this is what Alberto Mora told Congress, former Navy General Counsel, quote, "There are serving U.S. flag rank officers who maintain that the first and second identifiable causes of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq, as judged by their effectiveness in recruiting insurgent fighters into combat, are respectively the symbols of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo," unquote. And then you look at the denial of due process to these people, and also the refusal to bring to justice the big time war criminals, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and the rest, for their crimes. And these are war crimes that they have committed, and a war of aggression in Iraq, and a system of torture which has resulted in the deaths of at least 100 people and the torture of untold numbers of people. And you see, well, those are also going to be recruitment tools. And we wonder why the people hate us so much. One of the things that that didn't happen after 9/11, even with the 9/11 Commission, was any real serious inquiry about why 19 men were so angry that they would blow themselves up, and what is it? Is it that they hate our democracy? No, I don't think so. It's because of U.S. foreign policy. It's because of U.S. troops in lands where there are Arabs and Muslims and people generally non-white. You look at Osama bin Laden, who's, I'm no fan of his, but you look at what his pet peeves were. One was the U.S. troops stationed in Saudi Arabia near the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, the holy Muslim sites. Second were the genocidal sanctions against the people of Iraq during the Clinton administration, which killed a million Iraqis. And the third, Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands. So whether, you know, regardless of what people think about those issues, if we really want to protect ourselves from terrorism and prevent terrorist attacks against Americans, we have to fundamentally analyze and revamp our foreign policy so that we don't have bases in other people's countries and we're killing and torturing them, and then we wonder why people hate us.
Well, of course, that whole discussion is very taboo. In addition to the idea that the United States supports some very corrupt regimes across the world, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, and you can go on and on through the map of the Middle East. But Marjorie, before you go, I wanted to ask you briefly about a sad situation for longtime civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. Her bond was revoked, and she was instructed to start serving her 2-year, 4-month sentence for providing material support for a terrorist conspiracy. Could you just briefly update us on that case?
Yes. A 3-judge panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed her convictions and sent the case back to the trial judge for possible resentencing. She was sentenced to 28 months, and some of the judges on the Court of Appeals think that she should have gotten a longer sentence. She was convicted primarily because of her failure to abide by what are called special administrative measures that she had to sign in order to see her client in prison. And she communicated messages from him, or allowed the communication of messages from him, to outside people in violation of these SAMs, they're called, special administrative measures. Two other lawyers did so as well. They also violated these SAMs. They were not prosecuted. And there is one judge, Judge Calabresi, who concurred in the judgment but filed a separate concurrence, which talked about the trial judge who and his extraordinary ability and well-earned reputation for exceptional judgment, and talked about deferring to his judgment. And one of the very interesting things, and the trial judge, by the way, who heard this very complicated case, said that it was an atypical case, that no victim was actually harmed as a result. He took into account Lynn Stewart's stellar record of helping the poor and the downtrodden, and the fact that she's in ill health. She has cancer. She's 67 years old, etc. And one of the things that Calabresi said, Judge Calabresi, in his concurrence, was that all of the acts for which Stewart was convicted occurred before the attacks of 9/11, and he thought that the court should take judicial notice of their timing and recognize, quote, that our attitudes about her conduct have inevitably been influenced by the tragedy of that day. And really, the acts that she was convicted of took place before 9/11, and yet we have this 125-page decision from this 3-judge panel really reacting very strongly to the post-9/11 climate. And one of the judges, Walker, filed his own separate concurrence and partial dissent, and he went further than the 3-judge panel majority opinion, and he thinks that her sentence was unreasonable and would basically order the trial judge to raise the sentence. Calabresi is much more deferential to the judge, so even though they all agreed that the conviction should be affirmed and that the judge should consider alleged perjury that Lynn may have engaged in during the trial, saying that she intended to abide by the measures and didn't think they really applied to lawyers, and that she didn't know this this guy who was kind of an intermediary with people back in Egypt when these messages were communicated. The judge actually did take those into account, and the Supreme Court has said that the federal sentencing guidelines, which would give her about 30 years in prison, were not rigid, and that judges could should make an individualized determination of each case on its own merits. And so this judge, after hearing the whole case and knowing all about Lynn Stewart, decided to sentence her to 28 months, and this really incensed especially this Judge Walker. The other two went along with remanding the case back to the trial judge, but didn't instruct him that he had to raise the sentence. Just said to consider possible perjury and also obstruction of justice because she was a lawyer. So it remains to be seen whether this very highly respected judge who sentenced her, Judge Cotell, on I believe it's December 4th, I think, is going to consider her sentence again, and whether he will succumb to the pressure from this panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, or whether he will affirm the very well-reasoned decision he made in the first place to sentence her to 28 months.
Marjorie, thanks for taking the time to go into the case a bit of Lynn Stewart, and because I know you had a run out, and I apologize for delaying you, but appreciate the information. Why don't you, before we say goodnight, leave our listeners with the National Lawyers Guild website address, and I think I have another one here for the Lynn Stewart Support Committee.
Yes, it's NLG.org. That's the National Lawyers Guild. And if you just, I think you just do a Google on Lynn Stewart, and the first thing that comes up is her website, and it's constantly updated. In fact, if you want to read the opinions of the judges from the from the Second Circuit, there are links to them right at the top of Lynn Stewart's page, web page, and there's also an address if people want to write to her in prison.
Yeah, and I think the address of that website is Justice for Lynn Stewart. It's lynnstewart.org, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T.org. Marjorie, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for sharing some of your thoughts on these big issues with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott.
Take care, Marjorie.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild. It's NLG.org if you want to know more about the National Lawyers Guild. And again, LynnStewart.org to find out more about the Lynn Stewart case and the revocation of her bond that just occurred last week. Right now we have an announcement about a happier occasion. There's a big party for WPKN in New Haven, December 12th, holiday party. And here's some information for you right here. This is WPKM in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. And here's the lowdown on the party.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day.
Come on, get happy at the WPKN Holiday Party and Music Benefit on Saturday, December 12th from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Elegant Foster's Restaurant, 56 Orange Street in downtown New Haven. Join WPKN programmers, listeners, country rock duo Graylight Campfire, WPKN's own singer-songwriter Mike Horizon, and other musicians to celebrate the season. Enjoy an evening of great music, snacks, and special discounted libations at this benefit for your favorite listener-sponsored radio station, an event co-sponsored by Between the Lines, Squeaky Wheel Productions, and media sponsors the New Haven Advocate and Fairfield County Weekly. Along with a suggested contribution which benefits WPKN, please bring a non-perishable food item to donate to the Connecticut Food Bank the night of the event. Come on, get happy at the WPKN Holiday Party, Saturday, December 12th, from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Foster's Restaurant in downtown New Haven. For more information, call 203-331-9756 or visit our website at wpkn.org.
Come on, get happy. Chase your cares away.
Hey, cats and kittens, save the date for Zoot Planet, Sunday, December 6th, at FTC on Stage 1 in Fairfield. Zoot Planet will bring a night of swing, jazz, and blues. In support of live local radio, Zoot Planet shares the proceeds with WPKN. Tickets are $17, $12 for FTC members. For reservations, call the box office, 203-259-1036, or visit fairfieldtheater.org. That's Zoot Planet on Sunday, December 6th at FTC on Stage 1 in Fairfield. Support live music and support local radio, WPKN.
When God gave out rhythm, sure was good to you. You can add, subtract, multiply, and divide by two.
Some great events coming up. That's again the PKN benefit at Fairfield Theater Company, December 6th. That's a Sunday. And Saturday, December 12th, for the WPKN benefit holiday party. Hope you can make both, or at least one of them. Try and mark your calendars down. And right now, here on Counterpoint, I'd like to welcome our guest here, our next guest, James W. Douglas, who has for many years been active on the issues of peace and justice. He and his wife, Shelley, are co-founders of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Washington State, and also a Catholic workers' house they founded in Birmingham, Alabama. James Douglas, author of several books on spirituality and social action, published his latest book last year titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. James, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you, Scott.
And we got a chance to talk about your book last year, and it just seemed appropriate to invite you back on what we're now observing as the 46th year since the assassination of JFK in Dallas, Texas. And your book, JFK and the Unspeakable, looks into how the decisions made by JFK and how his transformation from a typical Cold War politician to a visionary for world peace may have provoked his murder. And I wonder if you just explain the title for us, as you did last time we talked. The Unspeakable. Where does that title come from?
Comes from a man named Thomas Merton, who was a great spiritual writer and a peacemaker in his own way from his monastery in Kentucky, in the hills of Kentucky. And he wrote a series of classic works during the 1960s, including Raids on the Unspeakable. And by the unspeakable, he meant a kind of evil, a systemic kind of evil that almost went beyond our imagination and our ability to describe it or to use words for it. It's a kind of void, both of words and of responsibility. And he gave us examples of it: the nuclear arms race, the escalating war in Vietnam, and the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. So the unspeakable is where we don't want to go, and that's especially the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which was carried out by these kinds of forces, and they're very much at the heart of our problem today.
Did Thomas Merton and his writings about peace and justice have any effect? Do we know Robert Kennedy, not Robert, but JFK's reading Merton's work? Do we know anything about that?
Well, it's very interesting that Merton was very closely connected with the Kennedy family. He, for years, had been connected with the Schakel family. Ethel Kennedy's mother, years before Ethel married Robert Kennedy, was in effect Merton's secretary. She and her staff were typing out his manuscripts after they were sent to her from Gethsemane, the Abbey of Gethsemane, and Merton was corresponding with Ethel Kennedy. Whether she handed her letters to John F. Kennedy, I don't know, but the Kennedys actually invited Merton to the White House and to their home to make presentations during the Kennedy administration, but Merton was a cloistered monk, and he didn't feel that was appropriate.
Interesting. And, you know, when people think of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, they think about his assassination, and his brief presidency, you know, is not examined in all that much detail here, you know, in 2009. But as you look back on Kennedy, who brought the United States and Russia and really the world very close to nuclear Armageddon during the Cuban Missile Crisis back in October of 1962.
Yeah.
How did that experience, and you write about this in your book, how did that experience change Kennedy's attitude toward dealing with the Soviet Union and Khrushchev and kind of reversed his Cold War mentality?
Well, Kennedy and Khrushchev had a secret correspondence going on. It was kind of what Merton was hoping would happen. Merton had expressed the hope that Kennedy would turn toward peace in some remarkable way, and that was going on even while Merton wrote those words, which he said, incidentally, would mark out Kennedy for assassination. And Merton hoped for that kind of change, and Kennedy and Khrushchev, in their correspondence, were even using an extraordinary symbol, that of Noah's Ark, which was raised by the atheist Khrushchev as the symbol of their relationship and what needed to happen in the world. He said in his first secret letter to Kennedy, "Mr. President, we're on this ark, and let's not try to determine who are the clean and the unclean in a sea of nuclear weapons. Let's just keep the ark afloat in this dreadful situation we're in." And Kennedy, reflecting from his home in Hyannisport, as Khrushchev had done from his home by the Black Sea, Kennedy said, "Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is our symbol. We've got to keep the ark afloat." And in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy was losing control of the situation, when his generals were trying to provoke the Soviet Union and trying to push Kennedy to attack Cuba and the Soviet Union in a war that would have ended civilization to the extent that we have any civilization in that kind of attitude, Kennedy reached out to Khrushchev, sending Robert, his brother, the Attorney General, secretly to Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador in Washington. He said, "I'm losing control. I need your help," to Khrushchev through Dobrynin. And when Khrushchev received that word, he turned to his foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko, and said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." Extraordinary. And then he said, hardly believing what he'd already said, "Yes, yes, we now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." And at that point, everything turned upside down, and Kennedy, who had been facing down his generals like General Curtis LeMay, who was insisting in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis that Kennedy attack Cuba, just as the CIA had been trying to get him to do in the Bay of Pigs, when Kennedy had said, "You know, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." Well, when Kennedy and Khrushchev, one reaching out to the other and the other saying, "You know, I must help this man," they became closer to each other than either was to his own national security state. And that was the upside-down nature of the movement that the conscience of each of them was taking. And it meant one would die 13 months later by assassination, and the other would be overthrown in the Soviet Union by his national security state.
So we know about this very extraordinary communication, private secret communication between Kennedy and Khrushchev.
It's all in official documents, and we have them in Foreign Relations of the United States, an official State Department publication, of course, many, many years after they've been uncovered through Freedom of Information Act requests. But
these,
it's all out there.
These letters are in your book, and they were declassified in 1993, right?
That's exactly right. There are 100 pages of endnotes with all the references and all the statements that I'm citing.
And that's, I mean, it's just so amazing even to think about it now, although, you know, we talked last year, but just remembering, and the book has this all in it, it's just, here you have Kennedy and Khrushchev making common cause against the militancy of U.S. generals eager to go to war here.
That's right, and life as we know it. His own generals.
they were making common cause against the military on both nations.
Exactly.
Wild. Now, there were some tapes released in 1990 that you also used to write this book. What did we discover from those tapes?
For example, we have all the tapes of the National Security Council meetings, the executive committee that Kennedy assembled during the missile crisis. And those tapes include, for example, Kennedy meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and after he tells them in no uncertain terms that he's absolutely not going to do what they're demanding that he do, LeMay is even calling him, General Curtis LeMay, head of the general in charge of the Air Force, is calling him a traitor, saying that what he's doing is worse than surrendering to Hitler in the Second World War. I mean, it's just atrocious. And Kennedy walks out of the room after he's told them that what they're recommending is unacceptable. Then we hear them cursing him after he walks out of the room. It's, you know, the tape keeps running. This is all public knowledge today, and they're saying on tape that they have the responsibility of seeing that what needs to be done will be done. It's their responsibility. This is total insubordination to the person they're supposed to be obeying, the President of the United States. And they tried to carry out those things, as I mentioned, by provoking the Soviet Union. For example, the Air Force sent missiles, so-called test missiles, fired them thousands of miles into the Pacific. Well, the Soviet Union, watching these missiles go off, is going to think that they're coming in a direction that is going to continue right into Moscow or wherever.
What time frame were those missiles launched?
In the middle of the crisis. So this was between the October 16th to 28th. It would have been a few days in, about the 20th or so, that the Air Force was launching these missiles, 1962. This is total provocation, and their hope was that the Soviet Union would give signs of responding to that, and then we had overwhelmingly superior nuclear forces, so we were going to engage in a total preemptive strike if the Soviet Union showed the slightest sign of launching their missiles.
So that's
when Kennedy contacted Khrushchev and said, "You got to help me."
Now, Kennedy did not authorize this test missile firing?
He didn't authorize. The Air Force was also flying into the Soviet airspace to try to provoke them. They're doing these things very precisely in order to push them, push, just like they were pushing the president. They wanted to win. Think about that word, a nuclear war. Mm. And they thought, well, the Soviet Union is building up its forces. Now is our chance, because we've got eminently superior forces, and we will only lose. This is their thinking, and it's very explicit in records that we have of their meetings. We'll only lose 20 or 30 million people in the process.
We will
win. They'll lose 150 to 200 million people. We will win.
This is, again, documented in your book.
It is all documented.
And you know, another operation that I know many of our listeners have heard of, many more haven't, but this is fact, not fiction, but the United States, and you can explain this in more detail than I can, in Operation Northwoods,
right,
was planning to actually launch false attacks within the United States, a false flag operation,
right,
that would be attributed to Cuban terrorists in this country.
That's right.
That would, again, it would provide the justification for an all-out U.S. invasion of Cuba. Now, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the mindset that was going on in the 60s during the Cold War that many of our younger listeners won't be aware of. But here you have the U.S. military planning to kill American citizens.
That's right.
To justify a war with Cuba.
These were the Joint Chiefs of Staff, unanimously. These are all the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in an official document that was sent to McNamara. Kennedy, of course, refused to do all of this, called Operation Northwoods. They had a series of ways to provoke the American public to engage in a war against Cuba, and one was to shoot down an airliner, an American airliner, and then do so in a way that would attribute it to Cuba. Another was to engage in a sabotage of a spacecraft and to blame it on Cuba. Another was to attack Guantanamo, which of course is part of the island of Cuba, and blame it on Cuba. And any of these, and all of these, you know, being synchronized or independently, were to give reason for attacking Cuba. Now, President Kennedy's assassination is an Operation Northwoods. Lee Harvey Oswald is a false flag operation in the sense that Lee Harvey Oswald is painted red during the summer before the assassination. Lee Harvey Oswald is in reality an operative for the Central Intelligence Agency and had been for years and years. That's all documented in the book. But he's been carrying out the orders of the CIA in the summer before in direct action operations in New Orleans that are associated with supporting Fidel Castro, so that and then in September when he goes supposedly to Mexico City, when somebody is acting as an imposter in his name, a man named Lee Harvey Oswald goes to the Cuban and the Soviet embassies, says he's going to assassinate the president, and that also he wants visas to Cuba and the Soviet Union. So this is a false flag operation, so that when Oswald is set up as a scapegoat in the assassination, when he's arrested, we'll blame Cuba and the Soviet Union. This is an Operation Northwoods. Fortunately, that didn't work. So the operation was successful in killing the president. It was unsuccessful in using the rationale of killing a peacemaking president for an attack on Cuba and the Soviet Union.
We're speaking tonight with James W. Douglas. He's the author of the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And we're talking about the JFK presidency and assassination on just yesterday's 46th anniversary of the murder of President Kennedy. James, I wanted to ask you a bit about the forces that were provoked and very hostile towards the Kennedy administration back there in the early 60s after the decisions were made on pulling back air support during the Bay of Pigs invasion by Cuban mercenaries and Cuban exiles, as well as how the Cuban Missile Crisis was settled, where Kennedy agreed not to any further hostilities towards Cuba, and in turn Russia decided to pull out some missiles from Turkey. There are a lot of sectors of the U.S. government, the CIA, the military, as you talked about, eager to go to war, who are very, let's not say disappointed, but very angry about the way these issues were resolved by President John Kennedy.
Well, Kennedy took very specific actions after the Bay of Pigs, for example. He not only said he wanted to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds, he fired the hierarchy of the CIA, including the legendary leader through the 50s of the CIA, who authorized all their main operations, Alan Dulles, the brother of John Foster Dulles. The two Dulles brothers managed the entire national security state during the Eisenhower administration. And in addition to firing Alan Dulles, Kennedy fired his chief lieutenant, so he was lopping off the top of the CIA. Then he said he wanted to, and he did, authorize a reduction in the CIA's budget, 10 to 20% in the next couple, 2 to 3 years. Then he got his brother, Robert, engaged in a major investigation of the CIA because of what they'd done in the Bay of Pigs. And from the standpoint of the CIA, all of these things were, of course, traitorous and murderous to their kinds of authority. And they manipulated the opinion of the Cuban exiles who felt that the Kennedy brothers had betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. Well, John Kennedy said he was never, ever going to authorize U.S. combat troops in Cuba, and the CIA had set up a scenario where, in order to win at the Bay of Pigs, he'd have to send in U.S. troops, have to heavily bomb Cuba, and he realized he was being manipulated and all of that. And of course, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy called them into his office to give them mementos and so forth in gratitude, he was being very, very nice about the whole thing for their support. Well, they hadn't really supported him, and they cursed him out in his office. And this is the Joint Chiefs telling the president that he should right then, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, bomb and invade Cuba. They thought this was our chance, this was our opportunity, and they walked out of the office, just stormed out of the office after that. Robert Kennedy and McNamara were sort of astounded at their attitude, although it wasn't all that surprising.
Now, what about Vietnam? There are a lot of views in history books about John Kennedy and his trajectory in Vietnam. He'd sent advisors there to South Vietnam.
He certainly had.
Military advisors were there.
Yes.
And, of course, after he was assassinated, Lyndon Johnson, after some delay, escalated the war into the debacle we now know as the U.S. wars in Southeast Asia that resulted in some 58,000 U.S. dead and probably close to a million or more Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians dead. But, James Douglas, tell our listeners a bit about where you think Kennedy was going in Vietnam.
We know where he was going. He authorized, he wrote, he signed National Security Act Memorandum Number 263 for a withdrawal of our troops from Vietnam, 1,000 by the end of 1963, and the whole bulk of U.S. troops out by the end of 65. He signed an end to the Vietnam War officially before he was assassinated in October of 1963, and he had struggled with his military advisors to get there. It told them to give him an exit plan for Vietnam in 1962. They didn't do it, and he kept telling them, I want an exit plan. He kept telling them, and finally he pushed it through by McNamara ordering these guys. They had semi-annual meetings in at Camp Smith in Honolulu, Hawaii, and finally McNamara said, we absolutely have to have this, and They still didn't give an adequate time plan. So Kennedy, he just wrote his National Security Memorandum 263, and all the troops have to be out by 65. And of course, when he was assassinated, Lyndon Johnson quietly ignored and voided the whole thing. Met with Henry Cabot Lodge, the ambassador to Vietnam, 2 days after Kennedy was assassinated, and said, "I'm not going to be the man to hand over Southeast Asia to the communists." So he reversed everything. And Kennedy wasn't handing over anything. He was negotiating an end to the war through a neutralist kind of settlement. That's what he wanted. That's what he had already done in Laos, the country right next to Vietnam. And we, you know, the history books ignore all of this. Kennedy had already set the precedent in Laos for what he was had then decided to do in Vietnam, which was negotiate a settlement for a neutralist government. It was all possible, and it was all in the process of being done. And it's all officially in the documents of the Kennedy administration, and historians ignore it.
James Douglas, there are, you know, dozens of theories as to who killed Kennedy. And you mentioned a moment ago that you thought Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy in all this, given the false flag nature of some of the things that he was engaged in living in Russia,
right.
His anti-communist conduct at certain points, his pro-communist conduct at certain points, very odd personality, and certainly gives some clues as to what may have been going on. But as I said, there are a lot of theories here. What is your theory as to what happened, given, you know, your book really talks about the forces that were unleashed and extremely hostile to Kennedy through these very crises in the Cold War?
Well, one has a hypothesis when you begin working on this stuff, and my hypothesis was that John Kennedy was assassinated by much more than Lee Harvey Oswald, but it's no longer an hypothesis. It's quite obvious. It's certain. All the documentation, all the information is out there. There have literally been hundreds of thousands of documents declassified since the early 1990s as a result of the JFK Records Act. John F. Kennedy was killed by his national security state in an operation that was coordinated by the Central Intelligence Agency. There is massive evidence for this. And behind all of that stands the military-industrial complex, which Kennedy denounced. Eisenhower had done it before him, but Kennedy did it in such a way through his actions. And in his American University address on June 10, 1963, he says, "What kind of peace do I seek? What kind of peace do I mean?" in a speech totally devoted to an end of the Cold War. He says, not a Pax Americana, not an American peace based on our weapons of extermination. He says, not that kind of peace. Well, that's the kind of peace that the military-industrial complex profited by, endorsed, and warned him against resisting in the midst of the steel crisis in 1962, when Kennedy faced down the leaders of U.S. Steel, what they called Big Steel, in a huge conflict over their reneging on a negotiation he'd done between them and the United Steel Workers Union. The leaders of the military-industrial complex, through Fortune magazine, in an unsigned editorial, warned Kennedy about the Ides of April. This is a warning about an assassination of the president. They're using Julius Caesar's assassination, as portrayed by William Shakespeare, where the soothsayer warns about the Ides of March. They say Kennedy better beware of the Ides of April. This is a year and a half before he will be assassinated. This is coming from the heart of the military-industrial complex, which he faced down already in the steel crisis when he was pulling out huge, huge military contracts from these major steel companies because they wouldn't go along with his what he had already worked out with them.
Well, James, I unfortunately we're running out of time here, and I want to get in one last issue.
Sure.
Here relating to the Obama presidency.
Absolutely.
Ted Kennedy and Caroline Kennedy endorsed Barack Obama during the midst of the very hard-fought primary battle within the Democratic Party before the November election last year.
You know where they did it?
They endorsed him. Well, as I know from your book and reading about this, the American University, the site of the June 1963 Kennedy Test Ban Treaty speech that you just talked about.
Kennedy's speech at American University is the perspective that we need to know to understand Ted and Caroline Kennedy's endorsement of Obama. They were saying, "We hope and believe that this candidate, Barack Obama, will carry out John F. Kennedy's vision of general and complete disarmament as articulated at American University," and they could have put in parentheses, "and at the same risk." And that's exactly what's happening right now. It's at the same risk, and Obama's up against generals who are running around the world telling him what to do, that we need 60,000 American troops, etc. Well, Obama is in exactly the same position as John F. Kennedy was, and we need to get way out ahead of him. We need to give him some space with, our pushing as American citizens for an end to the war in Afghanistan as well as Pakistan and Iraq, in the same way that John F. Kennedy was willing to do in Vietnam as he was in Laos and Cuba and in other places in the world that I mentioned in the story. So Obama's in exactly the same position. The story of John F. Kennedy continues in Barack Obama. We better understand that this is a story happening right now, not 46 years ago.
Right, and you know, it just seems reading the accounts of some of the very blatant public pronunciations made by Generals McChrystal and Petraeus about the need for more troops. It really puts President Obama in a box if he doesn't decide to follow this advice from his generals. And it is, in many ways, parallel to some of the insubordination that you just discussed about the generals who were advising Kennedy.
They're the current version of General Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs of Staff who are telling Kennedy, in Operation Northwoods, for example, which you described, an officially endorsed and proposed vision by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in which they were going to kill U.S. citizens and blame it on the Cubans. Now, I don't know what secretly is being proposed to Kennedy, but very publicly his generals are telling him what to do. That's the wrong way around. He tells them what to do, and we better support him in doing that. Otherwise, he gets isolated as in the way that John F. Kennedy did, and isolated to the point of his assassination in Kennedy's case.
You know, it's interesting, too, that we don't know where Barack Obama's going to go with his Afghanistan troop deployment decision.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's headed in the right direction from my perspective, but he actually, you know, very publicly told all his advisors that the options that they had given him were inappropriate and unacceptable, and that he told them to go back to the drawing board and start again. Similar to Kennedy.
In August, they didn't learn the first time around, so he's telling them all over again.
Yeah, but it's in some ways it's similar to what Kennedy was doing.
It's exactly similar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, James Douglas, any thoughts you want to leave us with briefly here at the end of this fascinating discussion on the 46th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination?
The important thing is that John F. Kennedy reached out to his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, and Khrushchev responded by helping Kennedy, and that was, you can call it different things. You can call it a kind of cosmic enlightenment. You can call it a miracle. You can call it doing what Jesus recommended in the Gospels, love your enemies, as interpreted by Gandhi, where you see the truth of your enemy. You can call it all kinds of things, but whatever it is, it's something to be thankful for this Thanksgiving, because had not John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev done that beautifully, beautifully unspeakable thing, we wouldn't be talking about it right now. This would be a nuclear wasteland. So thank God for John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev and the miracle of respect and of humanity that changed what could have been a nuclear war into the beginning of a peacemaking vision that we hope our current president will fulfill.
Well, on that, I hope we can all agree wherever we stand on political issues. But James Douglas, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight. And I hope our listeners will take a look at this very important book that you've written, as you said, with a very exhaustive list of documentation to back up what you declare in this book, and some of it fascinating, much of it fascinating and unheard of before. And that's the title of the book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. James Douglas, thanks so much for being on Counterpoint tonight with us.
Thank you.
All right. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
And we're going to make way for our final interview tonight in just a moment to talk a little bit about Connecticut politics here on Counterpoint. So do stay tuned. We'll be right back.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here, Mondays between 8 and 10. We're glad you could stop by this evening and catch us at this time on the radio, or you can go to the WPKN website or our other backup site, which is the White Rose Calendar, or I'm sorry, not White Rose Calendar, but WhiteRoseSociety.org, which archives the audio file of this program, Counterpoint, each and every week. That's WhiteRoseSociety.org. Some of the interviews heard on this program are also incorporated into the nationally syndicated show Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and you can go there at btlonline.org, btlonline.org, and you can sign up for weekly summaries, interview transcripts, and podcasts. And WPKN.org is the place you want to go to find out what's on this radio station at 89.5 FM and 88.7 FM. Right now, I'd like to welcome an old friend of this program, Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent, talking about some politics here in the state of Connecticut. Paul, thanks for making time for us, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Scott. It's great to be back on.
It's been a while. Too long. But, Paul, there's been, you know, a lot of things happening in terms of Connecticut politics, not least of which is Joe Lieberman's stand on health care reform that I want to get to a little later. But first of all, there's been a shakeup in what everybody thought was going to be the race for governor with Jody Rell's decision not to run for reelection and some speculation she might jump into the race for Senator Dodd's seat, where he looks pretty vulnerable these days, and a host of other Democrats and Republicans thinking about entering the race, including Ned Lamont, the old nemesis of Joe Lieberman, who unseated him from the Democratic Party nomination a few years back. But maybe first give us your two cents on where you think Jody Rell's decision came from not to run for reelection as Connecticut governor.
Yeah, I'm really not sure why she didn't run, Scott, but she hasn't been an active governor. She did very little every day. She would have one event. She'd go shake someone's hand or cut a ribbon somewhere.
That's why she's so popular, I guess.
Right, and she rarely talked to the press. And, you know, it was got to be less fun to govern. You're in a recession. Her own accounts were billions off at one point of how much money the state was going to be losing, what the size of the deficit was going to be. Just got to say no to everybody all the time. And they're doing a lot of posturing and fighting up at the Capitol. And I don't know if, and then they started being some scandals brewing. The Teflon seemed like it might not be protecting her as much as in the past. There was a poll they paid for with state funds to judge how her budget position was going to play out.
Oh, there was a UConn professor who was
right. They hired him, and one of the questions that taxpayers ended up paying for was rating Jody Rell versus Dick Blumenthal, a Democrat who was seen as a potential opponent for governor. So I don't know if that's what drove her out. I can't believe that item in and of itself would drive her out, but I think it got to be less fun for her.
Any clue as to what she might do next? I mean, there were rumors, and who knows where it came from. I'm not even sure where it came from, that she might be interested in running for Senate, given vulnerability.
I'd be very surprised she would want to run that risky a race. She's not someone who has ever run that competitive an election. She didn't have tough opposition for governor this time. I mean, she did terribly as a governor candidate. She couldn't debate, but she was doing basically what the more suburban oriented voters wanted in Connecticut. And she had personal popularity in that last governor's race. She got she ascended to the position when Governor Rowland resigned in a corruption scandal. She was, you know, a state senator from a sleepy part of the state for years, and that's it. She doesn't have the energy or the chops to run for a competitive Senate seat. You already have, first of all, Dodd is going to run hard unless he has another horrible poll and the party finally gets him to drop out. And you have very competitive Republicans running. I can't imagine a Rob Simmons or a Linda McMahon just stepping aside.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the Republican field that may step in to take Jody Rell's place, running as the GOP standard bearer for governor of Connecticut. There's this candidate, Linda McMahon. Oh, I'm sorry, she's running for Senate. Senate. She's running for Senate. Well, let me scratch
Senate,
that.
Senate Republicans are more interesting than the Republicans running for governor.
But let's talk briefly about them. And my mistake.
Yeah, the Lieutenant Governor Michael Fedeli, who again, like Rell, is sort of a He's not a right winger. He's a businessman from Fairfield County. Like Rell, he never went to college. He mostly is known for tourism videos. He hopes to step into the slot. I don't see him as that competitive. You have Larry Caffaro, who's an inside player as a state legislator in Hartford. Quite harsh kind of right wing type. I don't think the state would go for him. I think a lot of the people at the Capitol often think that that's the state of Connecticut, and they don't realize that the names aren't as well known beyond. And I mean, Caffaro's a good attack dog against the Democrats at the Capitol, but I just don't see them being strong for governor. Now, that's a risky thing for me to say, since the Democrats have not won a governor's race since 1986, a long time, in a state that has more Democrats than Republicans, and a state that has 5 out of 5 U.S. congressional seats held by Democrats. that's an elusive seat, that governor's seat. But when you think about who the candidates were who beat the Democrats in the past, they had much more going for them than the Democrats are seeing so far. Of course, that could change. Somebody else could emerge.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Democrats. We got Secretary of State Susan Bisowitz and former Stanford Mayor Dan Malloy and Ned Lamont, among the few that I know of.
Yes, State Senator Gary LeBeau, and the first selectman of Richfield. So, I mean, it's I think the race at this point is among the top three, Susan Bisowitz, as you said, Dan Malloy and Ned Lamont. There's also a possible fourth entrant, Juan Figueroa, who's the head of the Universal Healthcare Foundation, and he'd be a strong candidate, too. What's interesting, as you know, Scott, in primaries, the more progressive voters have a disproportionate say, and in general elections they have less. And there's going to be a real fight for that progressive vote. The one thing you have Lamont, who has residual loyalty from people who were pleased with him for leading the standard against Joe Lieberman. At this point, that's the biggest thing he's got going for running for governor, which is to wave a lot and say, I ran for Senate against Joe Lieberman, since everybody in the Democratic Party is ready to just scream every time Lieberman's name is mentioned. But Lamont's main issues in that campaign for Senate were very different. He ran on a Universal Healthcare Foundation, which is relevant to the state government, but also against ending the Iraq War, and for public financing of campaigns. I don't know how transferable that's going to be, Scott, because he's not a dynamic candidate. He has that loyalty and he has money, but even the money's getting him in trouble so far. People are really pressing him already. Are you going to run using your own money? Are you going to go for matching public money? And he's not answering that question. Susan Bisowitz has worked very hard to get loyalty from progressive groups. He embraced the push for universal health care in the state, the so-called Sustinet plan. She is a dogged campaigner. She spent her years up in Hartford at the Secretary of State's office just cultivating, you know, going into every town in the state and cultivating grassroots support. It's a very strong fundraiser. Dan Malloy ran for governor last time. He didn't get the nomination. He came close. I think he also has some ties among progressive groups, but he's not polling as well at this point. Bisowitz is leading in the polls. The surprise candidate, if he runs, I think could be Figueroa, because over the last few years there's been a push to pass universal health care in the state. Those forces did push a plan called Sustinet, which will gradually implement a plan. It's considered the template for the public option that's being debated at the federal level and would lay the groundwork for Connecticut to have that first. And in getting that passed, Figueroa's group had to build a coalition of activists, clergy people, small business people, groups that aren't necessarily all seen together usually, and they had to override, get the Democrats to override a veto by Jody Rell. So that would be an interesting campaign. I should just note for the record that the New Haven Independent, a nonprofit news site that I edit, has gotten funding from that Universal Healthcare Foundation, just to make clear any potential.
Full disclosure.
Yeah.
No, Paul, that's great. No, we've had Juan Figueroa on this program before, and have applauded a very monumental task that they succeeded in getting this public option, the Sustinet, passed, albeit without funding so far, but it's quite an accomplishment. And Figueroa, a former state rep, right?
Yeah, but he's going to make his decision by December 1st, so we're away.
Right. Now, what about the perennial non-candidate attorney general of the state of Connecticut? Dick Blumenthal is always speculation after speculation that he's going
to
jump in one of these statewide races or a Senate race. What do you think?
I believe that he made it pretty clear what he's doing the day after Rill announced he's not running. He left the door open to governor run, but he clearly does not want to run for governor. He made it sound like he's running against Joe Lieberman for Senate in 2012, but I think what he really wants, he's always wanted to be anointed to the next step. Blumenthal has been seen for decades as the rising star in the party, and now not so much rising. He's been around a long time as attorney general. Very visible, very popular. He's effective. He's gotten older, and people keep saying, is Dick going to run this year? Is he going to run this year for Senate? And now he looks back, and obviously he wishes he had run against Joe Lieberman in 2006, because he would have beaten him the way Lamont did in the primary, and unlike Lamont, he would have won a general election.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
So now what he's doing is, even though he's saying he's running against Lieberman, I think he wants to be the guy ready to run if Dodd drops out. Because Chris Dodd is a five-term incumbent, 30 years in the Senate, and yet he's pulling behind three Republicans, two of whom haven't even been known to anyone in the state for an awful long time. And he's already behind them about a year before the election, which shows how weak a candidate he is.
And he's weak because there have been some scandals have been following him.
I think
him around.
That, you know, for biggest appeal, I guess, to pay attention, we're obviously very concerned about the mortgage he got as a friend of Angelo, the head of Countrywide, mortgage company that he was supposed to be overseeing, a Senate Finance Committee, a cottage deal he got allegedly in return for helping this guy commit financial fraud, get a pardon from President Clinton. Those are real issues. I think people are just tired of him, though. I don't think people really follow the people are upset about the bailout from Wall Street that he did have a real hand in. He wasn't, as head of Senate Finance Committee, he really wasn't overseeing the finance industry the way as quietly as he should have been. He was getting a lot of money from him. But you got to remember, Scott, he has so many chits from the Democratic Party. Everything from family leave medication he championed to right now, in an effort to save his career, he's really taking a lead on the public auction in the health care bill,
right,
on taking on credit card companies for usurious rates. So Democrats feel that even though they're all privately saying, God, he's got to get out of there, we got to keep the seat, they feel publicly they can't do that. And in the meantime, activist groups feel like, well, in the meantime, we got this guy with all this experience and influence in the Senate. Since he's running really hard to save his career, let's get a lot of good legislation passed from him. But they also feel like they can't ditch him. So they kind of are hoping that he'll step out of the way. However, Dodd is a strong campaigner. He's a good politician. I don't think we should assume he would lose the seat. But it's in jeopardy in a way it wouldn't have been if, let's say, they had Blumenthal come up or something. So it's going to be a great race to watch. I don't think, the Republicans' leading candidate is Rob Simmons, a former congressman who was a CIA agent in Vietnam. He's really turning to the right. He's following this litmus test parade in the National Republican Party, where even so-called moderates, which we used to call conservatives, like Charlie Crist, who's running for Senate in Florida, are suddenly they're not pure enough for the wackos of the party. Rob Simmons is actually trying to copy that approach now.
Well, he's
not
scared.
His approach as a congressman, so he's staking out that ground. I'm not sure how that's going to sell in Connecticut. He's going to be a real candidate. There's no question. He's leading Dodd in the polls. He's got the name recognition. But I'm not convinced that when you see Dodd and Simmons stand up in a debate or going around the state in the crunch, I'm not sure that people are going to get warm and fuzzy to Simmons. I think Linda McMahon is sort of the dark horse candidate to watch if she'll, except I think she's making one error early on. She's a woman who co-founded and ran World Wrestling Entertainment with Vince McMahon, kind of they do the wild, crazy stuff. And now she's got so much personal wealth, she could spend as much as $50 million to run for Senate. And she's a successful woman, businesswoman from Fairfield County. So I think you got to see those as strengths for a candidate. Now, she's green. We had a reporter ask her questions over the weekend, which is the Harvard game. She didn't really have a position on Afghanistan. She didn't really have a position on the 9/11 terror trials. That was a little flap today from our story. So she's green. And the other thing she's trying to do is they're taking all their crazy kind of violent, sexist, funny video, quote-unquote funny videos from World Wrestling off YouTube so they can't be used against her. And her opponents, both in the Republican Party, Simmons going after Hart, as well as the Dodd people, are trying to brand her with that. You know, Scott, I think the mistake she's making is she should pull Jesse Ventura, the professor of wrestling who ran as an independent and won as governor of Minnesota.
Right.
I think she should embrace it. I'm not convinced the average person thinks that World Wrestling is so terrible. I think they think it's kind of funny that most politicians are boring. And if she ran as someone who, God forbid, had a personality, now I'm not saying this has anything to do with substance or whom we would like to see a Senate,
but
or
theater,
good
theater
for the country, because I think some of her early comments about for instance, the health care reform bill have been kind of simplistic and not necessarily what you want to vote for senator. But I think she should embrace being sort of this outsider, a little fun celebrity-type person, rather than pretending she's not someone who made a career and made a lot of money by kind of having some fun with people.
Sure, you know, crash a chair over somebody's head during a press conference.
Remember, Jesse Ventura had that ad in Minnesota, The Thinker, where they did it as a gag. He's like the Rodin sculpture. I think she should do that. Like, watch out if you get in the ring with Linda.
It would make good theater anyway. But do you think there's any way that Blumenthal would step in if Dow looks really weak to launch a primary challenge?
Absolutely not. I think they're in a club, they're friends. I think it would have to be a little subtler than that, Scott. I think we don't have a John Bailey anymore, the legendary kind of boss in the Democratic Party. I think people like you and me are probably glad about that. But That's what Bailey would have done in the old days. You know what's going on with Dodd is that his father's career, his father was a senator, and he had to leave in disgrace from the Senate.
He was censured, right?
He was censured, and then he lost it. And Dodd does not want to. He's used his time in the Senate. More recently, wrote a book to try to burnish his father's reputation. You know, he was involved in the Nuremberg trials and everything, and his father did some good things. He's tried to restore his father's reputation now to go out the way his father went out. I think that troubles him, and that is what partly is motivating him to hang on at a time when some people in the party might not want him to.
Hmm. Well, I guess if the polling is bad, he may step aside, given all that motivation to stay in the race and clear his name. But, yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of competing things there, Paul. I wanted to, before we run out of time, talk about Joe Lieberman, which is a fascinating story here with him threatening to join the Republicans to block a cloture on a final vote on the Senate health care reform bill if it's got a public option in it. Joe Lieberman says, you know, out of principles and conscience, he can't bring himself to let the vote go forward. But there were 500 people who thought differently, who held a candlelight vigil in front of his apartment building in Stamford, Connecticut, two Sundays ago. And people have been committing civil disobedience actions at his offices in Hartford and Washington, D.C. And there's a growing number of people in Connecticut who are flooding his offices with objections to his wanting to throw a monkey wrench and even getting a final vote on the Senate bill, which is certainly not a shoo-in anyway. It's a difficult task. But what do we hear about Joe Lieberman? Is he positioning himself to be the Democrat, the Republican candidate when he runs for re-election?
Well, the Republicans got him elected this time. As you know, when he ran in 2006, he lost the Democratic nomination, very bitter about it. Ran as a so-called independent, but Karl Rove and the Bush White House engineered his re-election. They made sure there was no serious Republican candidate. This guy, Alan Schlesinger, got no money, no support from the Republicans. The Republicans nationally worked for Joe, raised the money, helped him, as well as some lobbyist friends of his who came up. He ran as the Republican. And in 2000, and he's been so, you know, it's not just Joe. Everybody who gets in politics for a while feels they're owed a seat. And they feel like the voters don't have a right to disagree with them anymore and want them out. They get angry. Democrats didn't want him there anymore because he wasn't a Democrat. He was against Democrats on the major issues. He was so bitter about losing that primary, I feel he's still trying to exact revenge. And he's still trying to use his role as the key last vote to prevent a filibuster in the Senate to stick it to the Democrats every time he can. I mean, you know, he was the leading supporter of John McCain in the presidential election, the Republican. He's the guy who said, Sarah Palin, I met with her, she's prepared to be president, she can do the job.
He also was an attack dog for the Republicans. I mean, he was doing personal attacks on Obama.
On Fox News. But
yeah, exactly.
One thing he said about Palin, once someone says that, you know this has nothing to do with principle. So, yeah, he has become conservative. He does have more conservative views. But we know back in 94 when Bill Clinton was trying to push a health care plan, he actually said at the time that universal health coverage, that universal health care would be too quick a goal. He said that in 94. Now we're up to close to 50 million uninsured 15 years later, and it's still considered too quick and too expensive. So, I mean, partly that has to do with support, obviously, from the insurance industry in this state. But I also believe he's just mad. He's just spiteful 3 years later. He's so angry that he was rejected by Democrats that he just wants to get him every chance he can.
It's real personal, huh?
About, Scott. I think it's deeply personal. I think politics is so deeply personal.
Yeah, it does.
But, you know, the thing that troubles me more, everyone's talking about Joe and health care, and yeah, it makes them outraged. I think the very worst thing he did is the stand he's taking on the 9/11 trial. He's basically coming, you know, one concern people have about the turn the Republican Party took since Reagan is sort of an anti-intellectual, anti-constitutional turn. You know, we're seeing people attacking the idea people have rights under the Constitution or that we're ruled by law rather than just anger or revenge. And the argument against having the 9/11 trial in New York is that he shouldn't have the same rights and that we can't safely do it there. That's an incredible statement about our ability to have a constitutional government, the rule of law. And again, A, it's a shot at Democrats, but B, it's also just a dangerous alliance with a trend within the Republican Party, which is not universal, although it's kind of becoming so now.
So is his alliance with Fox News.
Yeah.
We talked about it.
I mean, I actually think that's the most dangerous thing Lieberman has done.
Yeah, we talked about the kind of pick-and-choose thing that the Obama administration and Eric Holder are doing with some of these defendants are going to be tried in civilian courts, some in revamped military commissions. But the bottom line, as you said, is really running away from our Constitution and the principles of law and, you know, having your day in court. And it seems like the Republicans and now Joe Lieberman are running squarely away from that whole concept.
Yeah.
That's taken us through a couple hundred years here. But where do you think Joe Lieberman's going to get off here in this health care debate? Is he going to be the person who's going to prevent the 60 votes to reach cloture and have a final vote?
I don't know, because you also got to look at Blanche Lincoln. I mean, I don't think it's just Joe. Joe, I think one analysis I heard here from politics in New Haven was basically every time there's a big issue up in Congress, every politician wants to be the last vote. The last person you got to make happy, the one who's going to get the most headlines because they're seen as the one. Like Bernie Sanders wasn't quite willing to say the other independent, but from the left to say I won't vote for this unless it has a public option because deep down he knows he'll vote for something that has a lot of good things he believes in. Whereas Joe and Lincoln, who needs to get reelected, Landrieu, they're willing to make those kind of statements. So I don't think it's just Joe, Scott. I'm kind of skeptical that you're going to see the public option in the final bill. I do believe that Emanuel and Obama all along have felt we're going to push for it to the end, but that's the trade we make at the end.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for running down a lot of these issues and candidates for us. And there's a lot more that you cover at the New Haven Independent that our listeners should check into on a daily basis. I know they can subscribe, too, for some of the headlines and links to what you do wonderfully over at that site, quickly replacing, I think, New Haven's other major daily newspaper. What's the web address there? And maybe say a word or two about some of the things you're covering these days.
Well, thanks a lot. NewHavenIndependent.org. And we just cover the city, New Haven, the criminal justice issues, neighborhood development issues, City Hall. We're doing a lot already on the races we've talked about on the show tonight. Check us out.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks for spending time with us, and we'll have you back soon to talk more about these races and the other things you're covering at the New Haven Independent. NewHavenIndependent.org, right?
You got it.
Okay. Take care,
thanks
Paul.
Thanks a lot,
Scott. Bye-bye. Well, that about does it for our show tonight. Please join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, hopefully with friends and family and lots of good food. Don't go overboard on all the pumpkin pie, which I guess is rare these days. They had a bad year for pumpkins. But at any rate, thank you all for listening, and we always like to hear from you. So if you have topics or guests that you'd like to hear on this show on Monday nights on Counterpoint, do ring through at 203-331-9756 or email me, Scott Harris, at betweenthelines@snet.net, betweenthelines@snet.net. And the snail mail address here at the station is for anything you want to say and suggest or even propose is WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. And again, our phone number here to reach the manager, Peter Beauchamp, or any of us is 203-331-9756. Right now, we're going to bring you Democracy Now!, which will be followed after an hour. We get to 11 p.m. by Free Speech Radio News from 11 to 11:30. And then I think we have Eric Cox in here at 11:30. I'm not sure that schedule sometimes changes up. But right now, Democracy Now! Thanks for listening. This is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Keep listening.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Medford, Oregon, broadcasting from SOP-TV, that's Southern Oregon Public Television.
Our plan saves lives, saves money, and saves Medicare. And they'll see the Republican alternative, which I'm sorry to say is non-existent.
Health
health care reform clears its first hurdle in the Senate after a 60-39 vote. Along party lines opens debate. We'll get analysis. Then, climate rage. That's the title of award-winning journalist Naomi Klein's latest piece in Rolling Stone. She says the only way to stop global warming is for rich countries to pay reparations to poor countries for the climate crisis. And a look at the planned protest for Copenhagen 10 years after the Battle of Seattle. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Democrats have moved one step closer to passing the major health care reform bill. In a party-line vote of 60-39, the Senate voted Saturday evening to open debate on the bill. Ahead of the vote, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid urged fellow Democrats to back the measure.
Don't try to silence a great debate over a great crisis. Don't let history show that when given the chance to debate and defend your position, to work with us for the good of our country and constituents, you ran and hid. You cannot wish away a great emergency by closing your eyes and pretending it doesn't exist. There is an emergency, and it exists now.
The Democratic victory has assured earlier in the day when the party's last two holdouts, Blanche Lincoln and Mary Landrieu, said they would support the motion but would not connect to backing the final bill without changes. Landrieu backed the vote only after she secured an additional $300 million in increased Medicaid funding to her state in 2011. Senators will begin debate on the bill next week. In economic news, the unemployment rate rose in 29 states last month. California, Delaware, South Carolina, Florida, and the District of Columbia all registered record rates of unemployment in October. In California, the jobless rate has reached 12.5%. The state has lost nearly 700,000 jobs over the past year. Michigan still has the nation's highest jobless rate at 15.1%. The president of the Chicago Federal Reserve, Charles Evans, said today he expects the national employment to peak at around 10.5% next spring and hopefully ease to about 9.5% by the end of next year. The New York Times reports Wall Street has found a new way to make money from the mortgage mess as millions of Americans struggle to hold on to their homes. Vulture funds are buying billions of dollars worth of discounted home loans, and then, in what might seem an act of charity, the funds are helping homeowners by reducing the size of the loans. But as part of these deals, the mortgages are being refinanced through lenders that work with government agencies like the Federal Housing Administration. This enables the vulture funds to pocket sizable profits by reselling new government-insured loans to other federal agencies, which then bundle the mortgages into securities for sale to investors while homeowners save money. The arrangement shifts nearly all the risk for the loans to the federal government and ultimately taxpayers. At the University of California, Santa Cruz, students have ended a four-day occupation of the school's main administration building, Kerr Hall. About 70 students took over the building on Thursday to protest tuition hikes. Meanwhile, at the University of California, Berkeley, 40 students were arrested on Friday night when campus police entered Wheeler Hall, which the students had taken over earlier in the day. Students at UCLA and UC Davis and San Francisco State also took over campus buildings last week. On Thursday, the UC Board of Regents voted to raise tuition by 32%. U.S. Special Forces have launched a secretive program to finance anti-Taliban militants in 14 areas of Afghanistan. The Guardian newspaper reports the U.S. plans to spend as much as $1.3 billion on the program known as the Community Defense Initiative. The plan has the backing of General Stanley McChrystal, but some experts warn the program could fuel long-term instability in Afghanistan. In the Philippines, a group of 21 people, including politicians and journalists, have been found dead after they were abducted on the southern island of Mindanao. The military said the group was kidnapped as they were on their way to an election office to file candidacy papers for a candidate for the governor's post. The candidate's wife, sister, and several other female relatives were among the group abducted and killed. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Israeli President Shimon Peres met on Sunday amidst growing anger in the Arab world over Israel's plans to expand settlements in the West Bank. Hosni Mubarak criticized Israel for continuing to build homes in occupied East Jerusalem.
Jerusalem is not only a Palestinian problem, but it's a problem that concerns all of the Muslims in the world. If we do not reach a solution on Jerusalem and stop its Judaization, it will be as if Israel has made an enemy of all Muslims in the world. And I have emphasized this topic because we want Jerusalem to be one of the topics on the negotiating table.
Israeli President Shimon Peres dismissed the criticism of the Israeli settlements, saying it was a marginal issue. In other news from the region, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem is reporting the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has claimed almost 8,900 lives in the past two decades, the vast majority of them Palestinian. B'Tselem said Israeli forces killed nearly 7,400 Palestinians, including over 1,500 minors, both in Israel and the occupied territories during that period. Meanwhile, Palestinians killed just under 1,500 Israelis, including 139 minors. 2009 has been the deadliest year for Palestinians in the past two decades. In news from Iran, former Vice President Mohammad Ali Abtahi has been sentenced to 6 years in jail for his role in the protests following the disrupted June 12th presidential elections. On Sunday, Abtahi was released on $700,000 bail. Last week, five Iranians received death sentences for taking part in the protests. In climate change news, 65 world leaders have announced they will attend next month's climate summit in Copenhagen, but leaders from the world's top three carbon polluters, the United States, China, and India, have not said yet if they will attend the meeting. Meanwhile, a new study by NASA has determined that about 57 billion tons of ice is melting annually in the East Antarctic ice sheets. The study raises new fears that global sea levels might rise faster than scientists had projected. Until now, scientists only thought ice was melting.